Hi, everybody, and welcome back to School Sucks Podcast for February 26th, 2011. Happy leap year. Usually only 25 days in February, so enjoy this day. Enjoy this year. Anyway, what you're going to hear today is a book discussion that I did earlier with people all over the world. Actually, most of them were in Europe. I was in the United States with a couple others, and we had one person join us from Canada. So I just want to give a quick thanks to everybody who participated, especially Jake, who invited me. This is the Freedom Book Club, and I will put a link to their Facebook page and upcoming events in the show notes for this show, which I'm going to split into two parts because the entire discussion runs about 2 hours. So yes, thanks to Jake. Thanks to Greg for setting up and managing the Skype conference. Other participants included Michael, Thomas, Cheryl, Debbie, Luke, and Ivan. And if I am forgetting anybody, I am very, very sorry. Stefan Molyneux joins us for about 45 minutes, a little bit into the discussion. Then he leaves a little bit early, so thanks to him as well. And yeah, I thought this went really well. I would definitely be willing to do something like this in the future. If anyone has a book, even if you're not in a book club, if you have a book that you've read on the topic of education that you would like to discuss, yeah, I might have read it, and I'd be happy to discuss it with you. We can put together a little group, we can jump on Skype, and we can have a good time. So, again, thank you for listening, and take care. The next installment in this two-part series will follow within a couple days. Bye.
Thanks so much for coming along, and welcome to the Freedom Book Club. We're going to talk about Instead of Education by John Holt. And I'm really glad that Brett from School Sucks Podcast has been able to make it. It's great to have you on, Brett.
Well, thanks for inviting me, Jake. Appreciate it.
I wanted to start by asking you a question about this book, actually, because I know obviously you have a background in education and have thought a lot about these issues. And I really loved this book. I thought it was amazing. I hadn't heard of John Holt until recently. My question really just to start was that I understand that this was actually, you know, in the sort of 70s and early 80s, that he was kind of quite a well-known guy, and that the whole idea of alternatives to compulsory schooling was, you know, at least, you know, not a completely marginal topic. It had kind of, it was around in the culture and people were sort of talking about it. And I guess my question is that right? And what happened to, if you like, the idea and the movement? Because obviously, I know there's been maybe a bit of a resurgence more recently, but it seems to have, you know, been around in the 70s and early 80s and then sort of just kind of got lost from at least from more mainstream debates. And could you say anything about that?
Yeah, and I hate to start on a negative note, but that's one of the things that I think is particularly sad. You know, somebody like John Holt, his body of work has been, you know, so influential in my development, my understanding of educational issues, and of course of compulsory schooling in the United States and beyond. But the impact of his amazing body of work on mainstream thinking is nil. You know, I mean, he did get into the spotlight in the 1970s, and certainly, of course, within you know, the circles where educational reform or educational issues is discussed, most people are familiar with his name. But all of his work, you know, and think about how influential How Children Learn, How Children Learn, Why Children Fail, this book and a couple others, it really didn't impact the institution of compulsory education at all. You know, despite all of his risks, his insight, his honesty, it did not change conventional schooling one bit. What it did do And this was ultimately Holt's conclusion after he spent, I think, most of the when he left teaching, he taught in the 50s, and then I think he became more of a voice in the 1960s and 70s. His ultimate conclusion was that the system could not be reformed. I think he spent a good chunk of his career as a speaker and an author saying that there was hope for the actual system. But he ultimately rejected that idea, and his later works, this book included, eventually catapulted interest in homeschooling and, of course, the concept of unschooling. But as we all know, institutional schooling in the United States and beyond has only gotten worse since he died roughly 25 years ago. So is that an answer?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and I was. You mentioned that he, you know, sort of spent most of his career, as far as I understand, sort of trying to reform schooling and education. And I always thought it was pretty impressive that in this book, this is obviously towards the end of his career and when he had basically given up. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was pretty impressive that he had the guts to admit that, you know, he changed his mind and that it didn't work. And that he was sort of then putting forward a different approach, which was, as the title says, you know, instead of education, actually alternatives to the whole idea of sort of schooling itself.
Right.
And I think it was really admirable that that he was sort of willing to relatively late on in his life to have quite a change of heart for somebody who was well inside the system, so to speak. But I guess, you know, why do you think it is that do you think it's just the sort of the fact that the state, you know, uses force to enforce schooling, that this has stayed so marginal? I mean, like, what do you think the reasons are that people don't know about this book and that he sort of disappeared from the landscape?
Well, I think that, you know, you're allowed to participate in a discussion about education if you're talking about reform. As soon as you switch, or as soon as your position evolves to the idea of getting rid of institutionalized public or compulsory schooling, you are marginalized. Because what the conflict ultimately wound up being was Holt taking this position of educational freedom, you know, for the benefit, for the enrichment, the development, the ultimate well-being of the learner. Well, that put him at odds with people who were extolling the virtues of the government education system, or even, you know, institutionalized schooling in general, for the purpose of discipline, for the benefit, ease, and comfort of the authorities. So when people think about what schooling is, and one thing that's I think right in the beginning of this book, right in the first chapter, he, you know, is very clear that we do not want to make this system more effective or efficient because its goal is not education. So while I would say,
right,
and I think Holt might even would have agreed with me, that public education is the most effective and successful government program ever, if you look at what the real goals, you know, stated by people like Dewey and Horace Mann and the Rockefeller Board of Education, if you look at what they were really trying to do, to use this system as a mold in a variety of different interest groups coming together to say, yes, we can get rid of Catholics and, you know, all these different ideas that people had for how this system of control could be used on the minds of children. We don't want to make education more effective or efficient because that would only ultimately mean more damage to young people.
Right. I get I think I understand sort of the how this worked then. So basically Holt became famous whilst he was still talking about reform, and that was sort of, even if they were sort of radical ideas in terms of teaching style and so forth, as long as it was within the context of school and a sort of compulsory education system, then he was, if you like, acceptable as a kind of debate. But when in the end of his career he went off over to educational freedom, then he basically got completely marginalized and forgotten, because he obviously at that point was no longer talking about things that were acceptable within the state education framework.
Yeah, I mean, and that's true with any debate that we have in society, whether it relates to economics or politics or education or any other issue. You know, you're welcome to participate in the debate as long as you're hacking at the leaves and the branches of the tree. But if you jump down and start really hammering away at the root, you're out, you're marginalized, and you have taken on a position that is unacceptable and outrageous. So
Right.
I'm not an expert. I'm obviously not a biographer of Holt, but my sense is that he was more accepted as an educational reformer than he was as a proponent of something like unschooling.
Right. Yeah. Well, I think, in terms of his biography, I also don't know a huge amount about it. But as far as I understand, he's an interesting character because he wasn't a libertarian. I mean, he wasn't an anarchist in his political outlook, and his advocacy of freedom from compulsory education seems to have been something that he came to quite late in life. But I don't, at least as far as I understand, it wasn't from a sort of principled, you know, looking at voluntarism and then applying it within the education field, so to speak. It was more he came to it from thinking about children and their well-being, and that was sort of what led him, I guess he was able to sort of follow through to the logical conclusions of that. But I don't, as far as I understand, he wasn't even, you know, particularly involved in the sort of wider issues of political freedom and voluntarism.
Well, I think what the only word that they probably had during most of Holt's career to use was libertarian. And obviously today we recognize that that's kind of bastardized and doesn't even really mean anything. But I've said in the past that, you know, there are few people, the only person that I can really think of off the top of my head that did more for libertarian ideas without ever really calling themselves a libertarian or recognizing their ideas as philosophically libertarian would probably have to be Rand. And she hated libertarians, by the way. But
I
think towards the end, maybe because there was a sort of burgeoning libertarian movement in the 1970s, that maybe Holt did warm up to that term. But I don't think he ever called himself a libertarian or considered himself a libertarian, but certainly did a lot for you know, that philosophy, because I think we recognize, and, you know, I think too, looking at a show or a body of work like Steps or Free Domain Radio, we see how dependent the state is, how dependent all of these authoritarian and, you know, domination systems are on the way that children are raised and that children are treated and that children are educated. And if there was a serious reevaluation of you know, early childhood and adolescence and how people should be raised or what education really means, well, the state wouldn't make any sense anymore. If young people were treated with respect, that would be it. So in that sense, Holt's work is incredibly important. But you're right, he isn't pooled together with all of the people who are considered voluntarist or libertarian thinkers.
Right, and you could argue that in some senses, you know, the fact that his ideas are sort of consistently, consistently pro-freedom and not coercive is far more important than whether or not he actually called himself a libertarian or you know, had any labels, because the fact is that he, as you say, he really had, at least in this book, I haven't read anything else of this, but I was just really impressed in this book at the sort of consistency and the rationality of his approach.
Right, yes, he is very consistent.
And I wanted to just say, I mean, one of the things that really impressed me about this book is that he starts off by making a distinction which, for me, just blows a lot of sort of discussions that are dead ends completely out of the water, because he starts off by being very clear that the difference in sort of education for him, like the single difference that really matters is not whether or not a school is nice or whether it has a good pool and nice gym facilities and it's got lots of musical instruments for the kids to play, or whether they have time to, you know, wander around the school grounds or whatever. None of that for him is actually the distinctive thing that matters. For him, the key difference is between whether or not you are there compulsorily, whether or not it's what he calls like a capital S school, or whether or not it's a place of learning where you've chosen voluntarily to go, like, you know, a language center or even just a friend who happens to know how to do something that you don't know. And that, I mean, it just makes perfect sense that that psychological difference of whether or not children are being told, in not necessarily in direct verbal terms, but are being told by the circumstances that, you know, you will be forced to stay somewhere, whether you like it or not, and you will be forced to adopt these ideas or at least parrot them back. It just doesn't matter how nice the school is. That itself is such an undermining idea for someone's selfhood and their, you know, and their development, that it really hasn't got anything to do with learning. And he goes on to talk about the relationship with, you know, the Milgram experiments and people's deep sort of sense of authority that comes from, well, in his view, schooling, but obviously from our view, probably parenting as well. But I just thought that was a really nice distinction to draw between, not between the sort of quality of the school, but the actual psychological message that the child is either being coerced into doing something or they're not.
Right, absolutely. And I have one of his quotes here. My concern is not to improve education, but to do away with it, to end the ugly and anti-human business of people shaping and to allow and help people to shape themselves. And we think about what a foreign concept that is. And to most people, when you talk about this idea of doing away with these compulsory systems, it really shows the impact of the system on the constraints it puts on the thinking of most victims. I think that the important theme in this book is education versus, or what's traditionally been defined as education, which he does the all-important job of redefining. Traditional education versus doing is just such a paradigm shift of letting young people explore and do. And whenever I've had these conversations in the past with people, they say, well, how will, if there's not school, how will they start learning when they're six? You know, why is that deemed mandatory?
Right.
What's stopping, stop preventing people from doing, stop trapping people. Stop crippling curiosity by interfering with their ability to act on it. In school, you sit still. So all of that curiosity and all of that intrinsic motivation is just crushed. There's nowhere for it to go. So, yeah, I mean, the psychological impact, if I'm following what you said correctly, the psychological impact of that is tragic, devastating.
Right. Well, there's lots of people on the call, and if anybody, this is just simply a free-for-all, so if anyone wants to chime in at any point with your thoughts about the book and about unschooling, then obviously just go ahead, guys, if anyone wants to get in. Anyone got anything they want to say about the book?
I just wanted to throw in how much I'm enjoying it at the moment. I mean, I'm a fifth of the way through the book, or I guess just over a quarter. And I'm just really enjoying it. I'm finding it a real relief, just sort of stepping back from my life so far, looking at my education and how I chose to then follow on from compulsory schooling, going to university, and dropped out of that and felt guilty for it. Felt like I'd failed at life, failed at the career that I'd meant to be building up towards. And but it's a real paradigm shift that I've gone through. And reading this book really opens a window to a new life, how I can, literally replace what I was expecting after university by the solutions John Holt's put forward. that I could have instead of education. Like, it's great to feel fully conscious of how what's more fulfilling is looking for extrinsic motivation rather than intrinsic, or I guess the other way around. Yeah, intrinsic
like, yeah,
than extrinsic. Yeah, like, I mean, like, I'm learning the violin at the moment, and there's no way I can just, like, put up with the slog of, you know, the bad aspects of learning an instrument. Like, it annoys housemates, and this kind of, it's expensive, and this kind of thing, because there's a reward at the end, or because, I don't know, I'll find a teacher who praises me, and that's all that keeps me going. Like, it's the process, it's the journey that's actually interesting, and I've completely been indoctrinated that's not the case. I've really experienced what Brett describes as like being crushed by education and the indoctrination of that, and I'm just sort of, I don't know, just rebuilding my life and seeing how I can actually live my life and learn differently without being educated, if that makes sense.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I think one of the things that I noticed about this book is that it's a wonderfully optimistic and really positive and really well-argued sort of case for, as you say, you know, intrinsic motivation and getting just learning by doing, by just getting on with life, basically. And I found that really uplifting and really, you know, really sort of helpful and constructive in terms of thinking about, you know, if we have kids in the future, you know, what we'll do in terms of, you know, helping them just get on with it, basically. At the same time, it's interesting, though, because I know what you mean. Looking at this book, you realize, bloody hell, I've been in prison for so long. You know, I was in effectively a prison. And I intellectually sort of understood that from the libertarian ideas anyway. But this book really hammers it home, because it really sort of makes it clear just how prison like compulsory schooling is and what that is about. And Greg, if you could add Steph, he's just asked to be added to the call, that'd be great.
I totally agree with what you're saying about the optimism as well. I've really enjoyed that as well. Like, he's pointed out a lot of silver linings that I really didn't see before. Like, I felt ambivalent when I read what he was saying about the about what we could do with libraries and how the functions of libraries could be extended, perhaps with more funding from the government and more investment of local people's time and more, you know, volunteer work from the community. I felt ambivalent when he was talking about what we could do with libraries, because on the one hand, I know that, you know, there's that old quote, the state or statism is the fiction by which everyone tries to live at the expense of everybody else. So I didn't like that. But at the same time, I really admired how at least he was saying, well, I hate the system and I resent it, but let's make the most of it. I hate the fact that children are, you know, put in these prisons in the school system. But at the same time, we may as well be able to have access to these buildings outside of school hours, at least. And I really wouldn't have thought of that, how they've got all these art utensils and, you know, musical instruments and this kind of computers that are under lock and key for safety, I guess.
Well, yeah, he's sort of arguing for opening up the school facilities to competition, basically. It's like, you know, getting other people to have the opportunity to use them as well. And what I thought was interesting about all those suggestions, and like you mentioned the thing that he says about libraries and like using schools out of hours and stuff, and he's got all these basically suggestions about resources for unschooling in this book. But what struck me is that this obviously was written in the 1970s, and a lot of the stuff that he's dealing with is like how people can get in touch with each other by posting on message boards and all of that. And obviously now, I mean, a lot of the things that he's talking about are just so easy compared to how they were back then, because now, you know, we have communication means that are just in another planet compared to what John Holt was dealing with. And even back then, he was showing how it's quite possible to get hold of people with different skills who you can learn from outside of a school system, that you can, you know, quite easily within any city. Obviously, you, in his day, you can basically link up with other people who can teach you things. And in our time, you know, you didn't even have to worry about being in a big city because we've got the internet. And so there's loads of ways of getting in touch with people.
Yeah, no, I mean, anyone who runs a podcast is basically unschooling.
Yeah. I mean, a podcast itself is like an unschooling resource.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wanted to, like, say something about the psychological impact and the thing, like, Tom mentioned about the violin teacher praising him. I had like a similar experience with singing, because I'm learning to sing, and I also have a good teacher. But the thing is, she said that she basically has to, and she keeps saying this over and over, basically, that she has to deprogram almost every student that comes to her, because everyone is so afraid to make mistakes after, you know, after going through all the years of compulsory education, that people are freaking terrified, you know, to try something and to make mistakes. And she has to like explain on and on and on that nothing bad will happen, and yeah, and that people come to teachers to try to do their best to make mistakes and to improve. But it's so, the fear is so, you know, deeply ingrained in them that that it's a real struggle for her to, you know, to get people deprogrammed from that kind of stuff.
Right.
Yeah, that's a great point, actually, Ivan. I remember just how much of a risk aversion kind of atmosphere there was in schools, and everyone was terrified about actually coming up with some creative idea, or even putting their hand up sometimes to answer a simple question. And I think that kind of fear of being able to express oneself and ask questions that the school system cultivates is actually part of what leads to the boredom and monotony, because no one can kind of step out of line or challenge the curriculum. It's just, this is the sludge that you have to put up with. And I can remember that feeling in schools of just that absolute claustrophobic boredom. But no one being able to kind of say anything about it. And that was what was so horrendous, like thinking, oh, I've got to come in tomorrow, and then the next day, and the next day, and then however many years in advance. And that was just kind of crushing. And so, I can completely understand when I was doing music lessons, I had a similar experience where the guy teaching guitar was sort of saying that, you know, trying to get people out of that habit of just looking to repeat back information rather than actually try to enjoy and become engaged in the experience itself.
I remember when my brother was learning guitar at home, he didn't go very far in it, but he would get so nervous before the guitar lesson that I remember the guitar teacher actually suggested he take a shot of liquor before before the lesson so he could relax and enjoy it a little bit more.
Gosh.
I liked the way that he used the materials after the conflict when he was talking about that woman who came up and said, you know, it's destructive for you to intimate that power warps the teacher-student relationship. And she sort of let her run for about 10 minutes and then said, well, you know, would the other people in your school have power over you? And she said, well, yeah, of course. And he said, well, would you speak to them in this way? In the way that you're speaking to me. And she said, no, I really like that sort of.
Yeah, that was awesome. That was such an awesome comparison.
Because, yeah, I mean, the temptation is so much to go into abstracts, and the value is so much to deal with the materials of the immediate.
Absolutely.
Now, his distinction between cap school and low cap school was pretty much the difference between compulsion. I don't think he spelt it out. At least I didn't find a place where he spelt it out really explicitly. And I'm sorry if I'm joining late, but just this has been discussed. But I got the sense that he's really talking about the difference between violence and voluntarism, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Because that seemed to be his major distinction, right? That nobody was forced to be there, that the school wasn't banning anybody else from doing stuff or whatever.
Exactly. And we were just talking about, you know, the one of the things that what really impressed me is that as the key distinction, you know, takes a lot of sort of peripheral things it stops you getting distracted by a lot of peripheral things. It's not about how good the facilities are or how good, the music department is or whatever. The key thing that he's focused on is it coercive or not? And once that, if it's coercive, then, you know, in a sense, doesn't matter how nice it looks, you can't get beyond the poisonous message that coercive nature actually prints on the child's experience. And I thought that was really powerful because it means, you know, it's a really good principle to be able to evaluate, you know, what the experience is going to be like for the person who's actually going to go through it, for the kids.
And that's the frustrating thing, at least the frustrating thing that I found with the book, was that because he's not a philosopher, so he's not going to extract the principle from what bothers him in the moment and universalize it and take on society from that standpoint. So he's going to say, well, I don't like compulsion and bribery and threats for kids in school. And, you know, who's going to disagree with that? I mean, I think everybody's going to say that's most people will say that's a good thing. But that also was not an uncommon view in the hippy-dippy era, you know, not to sound dismissive, but in the hippy-dippy era that he was writing, there was a lot of sort of free love and peace and let's not shower or whatever that was going on in the 1960s, which is, I guess, when this guy was emerging as a writer. But the lack of capacity to extract that in generalize it as a principle is always, to me, kind of frustrating. And I think that's one of the reasons why this movement, you know, he says we're probably going to have it for another generation. It's like, oh, if only that had been true, right? And so I think it's important to look at what's not there and hopefully learn from it.
And I think, too, if you look at the larger picture of his career, and he weaves this idea pretty consistently through a lot of his work and a lot of his books, but it is very much a practical argument. I believe he worked with younger kids, like elementary school kids, when he was a teacher. And he was very firm and very consistent that children don't need to be coerced into learning. Young people want to learn. They just need the freedom. They just need you just need to be able to let that curiosity go and don't try to trap it in a desk. So, yeah, you're right. There was no, abstracting that to the larger picture. It was very practical. He said this is not the best way for young people to learn with coercion. And that from what I have seen of his work, that's as far as he ever took it. He did not speak the same language, I guess I would say.
Sorry, speak the same language as what?
He did not, you know, say that the initiation of force is wrong in this occurrence and all others. He was talking about it from, you know, a practical standpoint, that this is not the best way for young people to learn, to be coerced into learning.
Right. So you,
which of course
you mean?
That brings up the question of best for whom, right? It certainly is better for the state if children are coerced into quote learning.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Because it breeds fear and the insecurity. So this is that's the argument from effect problem, which is like, well, okay, best or worst for who? But I think he definitely got that the status quo in education serves the power structures that exist. I think that was, I mean, unless I misread it, I thought that was fairly clear.
No, I think he did get that. But yeah, I guess Brett, I can see what you mean. That if he came at this from a sort of, you know, being a teacher at the coalface type of approach, that he was interested in effects, he was interested in what would be the best way to facilitate learning. And so his argument then sort of grew out of, you know, coercion just doesn't work, as opposed to being a more universal coercion is wrong in all cases and including in education. And therefore, you know, that it following from that. But I still think that it's remarkably, we were just talking to Steph earlier that, you know, he didn't call himself a libertarian, this guy. And we don't know quite how much contact he had with wide or an anarchist or anarcho-capitalist, whatever. We don't know how much contact he had with sort of people, few people who were around in those days. But you know, even though he didn't call himself that and probably didn't think in terms of wider ideas of non-coercion and the non-aggression principle, he still applies it pretty consistently. You know, if it's not sort of understood, he still applies it pretty consistently in this particular field, just in terms of talking about education. And I think that's, you know, in terms of everything that I've read, this is the most consistent thing I've read on sort of, you know, from a sort of teaching or education perspective about applying the non-aggression principle.
I didn't get to the last few chapters, which I apologize, so I'll keep this question brief in case you dealt with it. But does he talk much about parenting?
I don't remember him talking that much about parenting. Like, one of the things I did notice is that his argument about he references the obedience of people in society, the Milgram experiments and so forth. And he very much says, well, this is, you know, it's not surprising because they've been in prison all these years. They've been in compulsory education. But I don't think he does really touch on parenting very much at all. And I think he just talks about education. I don't know if anybody else who's read the book remembers anything. But, yeah, I think he avoided parenting.
Why do you think?
Well, he wasn't a parent himself. Apparently he never had kids. But obviously he would have seen the effect that the parents would have had on, you know, class after class that presumably he taught. And I bet, you know, it's because it would have been an extremely volatile subject.
No, I don't think that would be true. Just kidding. Yeah, well, I mean, certainly teachers can be pretty anxious about parents. I certainly heard this from a number of teachers that they, you know, they can clearly see that parenting is the significant cause of the problem, but they can't bring anything up. And so that may have been something that he just, you know, whether you say wisely or courageously or discretion is the better part of valor, who knows? But it is something that he seems to have avoided. And that's always kind of tragic to me, the missed opportunity, because I think that communicates itself to others very, like, unconsciously, but very powerfully.
Right.
I'm not sure. I think, like, you're a little bit harsh, Steph, because, I mean, that was, like, what, 30 years ago? I think that for his time, he was, like Jake said, it was really consistent, at least when he applied this to education. Of course, there was, like, a missed opportunity, but for what it's... I think it was pretty good for its time.
And you could be exactly right about the harshness. I mean, I'm certainly not going to argue with you on that. I certainly could be too harsh, but because he himself defines education as not a teacher-student thing fundamentally, then I think he would have to view the first educators of kids as parents, wouldn't he?
Yeah, I guess so. Yes, of course. But, you know, the way I look at it, people have, like, a huge problem with looking at parenting like right now today, so I can only imagine what kind of resistance there would be in his time.
Well, that may be begging the question, right? Because if people like him had taken it on, it may not be so difficult. Well, it wouldn't be so difficult today, right?
Yeah, that's true.
Did Brett make it on, by the way?
Yeah, I'm right here.
Yeah.
Oh, hey, Brett. How's it going?
Hey, Steph. How are you?
I'm good. Good. Thank you. All right, well. I'm well. Let's get our grammar correct with the teachers. Superman does good. You do well.
So I had a question for I know that we've got people on the call who've sort of been who've got kids, and also maybe you know, Brett and others who have taught kids. What are your thoughts about applying, you know, the suggestions in this book of unschooling? And I mean, has anyone had any experience with unschooling? And could, you know, would you like to? Is there anything you'd like be willing to share with us about actually taking these ideas and, you know, putting them into practice?
I'll let anyone who has kids who's tried this go for it. I mean, I have a little bit of experience, but I'd certainly like to hear what other people have to say if they've done it with their own kids. Oh, Or I could talk a little bit about the school I just spent some time working at.
Ooh, I'd like to hear that.
Sure.
Go for it.
A while ago on my show, I had a woman named Kate who was on the board and was the treasurer of the only school for the gifted in New Hampshire called the Scholars Academy. And unfortunately, the school just closed because they decided to convert it into a charter school, which means, you know, the state hangs some money down and a lot of these private schools are grabbing it and converting to charter schools for that reason. So a lot of the people who were fundraising backed away and said, you know, that takes away the uniqueness of this place, of this program, and the school just very quickly shut down because of that, which was sad. But I went in to do some enrichment classes with elementary age. There are no grades, of course, at this school, but these were elementary age children. And I had not been in a classroom, in front of a classroom, in the role as the facilitator or the teacher in 5 years. And trying to you know, do something educational in a very decentralized way is certainly a challenge. And I think that it's going to be an evolution from, you know, where we are now to unschooling is such a long journey, especially if you consider, you know, where most people stand as far as their attitudes towards education are concerned. People like the building, you know, they like a place where the kid goes. And I think that before young people are really totally set free and most people would be open to following the suggestions that Holt makes in this book and in other places, there needs to be some kind of transition to these, you know, at the very least, parent-run schools where you know, kids go and they interact, and I don't see it as a jump that can be taken in any meaningful way from, you know, the state that we're in today, where over 90% of people are educated by the government, to a more free and open child-centered form of education. So I definitely think that there is an important transition, and really, I don't want to be overly practical about it, but I think it is something that's going to take time. I mean, certainly if I had my own children, that's how I would like to see education happen. But you know, another important point that Holt makes that I tried to make this happen at Scholars Academy was, you know, learning is doing. Like, education has this other definition. And, you know, he's just talking about let people do stuff. You know, people want to learn. They don't need to be told how to learn. They want to and they know how. So that's about it.
Yes, I guess so. You mean that at least even though there's a long way to go to get to sort of full unschooling, do you mean like that you can still apply some of the kind of doing approach, even maybe, you know, not necessarily in a fully unschooled way? Is that what you mean?
Yeah. And I think that there's ways that parents can even integrate these ideas that Hope puts forward if their kids are in public school. I mean, there are some people in situations where they are just trapped. They do not have anything else to do with their children during the day, and they spend, libertarians included, people here in New Hampshire included, and they find themselves rationalizing public school, and they say, oh well, you know, I'll just make sure that I undo whatever damage when the kid gets home. But there is, yeah, there is a long and winding road between where we are and I think where education, I'd like to see people's attitudes towards education ultimately go. But it doesn't mean that we can't start incorporating some of Holt's ideas in the interim.
Yeah, I thought it was really, I thought it was great that he actually makes a suggestion in here as well for people whose kids are stuck in public education. And he'd like, his basic suggestion was that just be honest with the kid that if it's a stupid game, you know, and if they're expected to, you know, parrot back, you know, these things in in these classes, then just be honest with the kid and help them to to do whatever it is they need to do to get through that stupid game, basically. And he even had, I can't remember exactly what it was, but he had like some suggestion about if you can get hold of the answers and maybe you can make it fun to actually try and predict what it is that the teacher's gonna do from their teaching manual. Well, that's it. He says he suggests get hold of the teaching manual and just make it transparent, help make it as transparent as possible for the kids what it is that they're being sort of subjected to. Because if it's, very much that they will be essentially spoon-fed a bunch of, conclusions, mm-hmm. then, you can at least sort of help the child to effectively just cope with having to go through that rather annoying and frustrating and tedious process.
Yeah, I think you can certainly blow away a lot of the fog. And I really try to do this. I teach these SAT classes. We talk a lot about persuasion, persuasive writing. And a lot of people think that the essay process begins with a thesis. And I would say, as far as the whole process is concerned, that's closer to the middle. The thesis is a conclusion that sits on top of facts. So if you can point out to, especially, if you're realizing these things when your kids are in middle school or high school, yeah, they're being spoon-fed conclusions, especially in classes like civics or history. Start saying, is that just the capstone of a pyramid hovering around in midair with nothing underneath it, or is that verifiable? Are there facts underneath it? Where did this story come from? And I think if young people can be taught how to make reasoned arguments, then yeah, they can see through a lot of the BS that they're being fed in these schools. It's sometimes in my career, a lot of the kids I worked with were in high school, and sometimes it felt like no matter what I could do, especially when I was a classroom teacher, it was too late. There had been too much damage done, but I don't think it's ever too late to start trying to correct that.
Right. It seems to me, we were just talking about this earlier on today, if we have kids, would we run school and what would it be like and so forth. And it seems to me that obviously there are a lot of practical considerations and financial considerations about unschooling. And obviously, you could go into a lot of discussion about, how that would work. But I guess one of the main barriers is going to be also just the potential, the social ostracism and the difficulty of being so far outside the mainstream. I mean, that's going to be a challenge because obviously it is such a completely unquestioned social norm that kids are in school. And even if not, that then they are, doing some kind of homeschooling equivalent, they're basically following all the same books and everything, just with their parents, acting like the teachers in the kitchen. And it seems to me that itself, at least for us now, is one of the, that must be one of the big considerations is how do you deal with, the life that the kids are going to have encountering other kids who are basically in prison all the time and don't even know it. And it's quite a long way outside the norm. And I think that's going to be an interesting social challenge.
And of course, it's remarkable how people are so embedded in the system, because when I've talked to people about unschooling before, I obviously don't have children myself, but just about the idea, the concept, because I work in a kind of an environment where we make learning products and stuff, so education and learning is talked about quite a lot. And the mention of unschooling, one of the most common objections right off the bat, even from people who don't know that much about it and haven't put that much, you know, study into it, sort of say, well, wouldn't it be like a kind of social ostracism and therefore unfair on the child because, you know, they don't get to be with other kids, they don't get to be part of the system, and that's unfair. And it's like, well, I mean, maybe that's the case in, sometimes, I don't know, but like, assuming that that's true, then they never say, well, that's because the government has all these millions of children locked up in prisons. So it's always, oh, no, that's therefore unschooling is just a bad idea. Because no one's actually working from the principle of what's good for the children.
Right.
And I think these people, all, maybe it's different in other countries, but from what I remember when I was a kid, it's not really true that most of the socializing happened in school. In school, you just had to be sort of hang out with these people because you had no choice. But in reality, what happened was like after school, all the kids just went out to play, to play outside. And that's where right. the socializing happened. So it's something like, I don't know if people sort of forget this stuff or what.
Well, then if it's forced, it's not socializing, right?
Yeah, exactly.
You can't really, you can't use the same word, right? That's
absolutely.
Like using love making and rape interchangeably. I mean, if you're forced to go to school and forced to sit in rows with people and forced to have recess with them and forced to be there, and I mean, that doesn't teach you anything other than forces your environment. That's not socializing.
Yes, and that's another thing. I remember like also getting into a discussion about education with a group of people, and somehow the topic was that most of the children in school are like lazy and they will not amount to anything. And I sort of jumped in and said like, wait a minute, how can you, if they are made to go there by force, then how can you even apply the term lazy to that? I mean,
that was the same excuse that was used for slaves, right?
Yeah.
Slaves,
yeah.
You need to whip them because they're lazy. It's like, no, the cause and effect is,
That's the point. But again, when I said that, it's I met with such huge, like I was overshouted, you know, basically. So there's no talking to people about stuff like that.
A friend of mine, a local listener, had a great idea. Said the best way to end public education in about 3 days is to teach rules of positive, peaceful, and effective parenting to the kids.
That's a really powerful idea. Do you mean like if you were a parent yourself, like how would you like to treat?
No, if you just teach that to the kids, right? Then the kids go home and the parents may be aggressive or yelling or whatever, and they say no. At school we learned that this is wrong.
Right.
The parents all storm and pull their kids out. Anyway, it's just a sort of whimsical idea, not particularly a plan, but I thought it was kind of interesting.
And what's interesting as well is that the teachers obviously have a lot of incentive not to teach the children real ethics and creative thinking and thinking as a and learning as a process, but actually just bombarding them with all these conclusions and facts and knowledge, even if it's something that's logically true or something, but just the whole form of it. Because they themselves are embedded in this stuffy, horrible bureaucratic system where all they're doing as well is just regurgitating this stuff, and then the kids are just regurgitating it as well.
And boring is inoffensive, right? So if the parent teaches some sort of critical thinking skills that then puts the child in collision with social prejudices, I mean the acceptable ones, right? Like statism or religion or whatever. The parent is going to get, whoever is offended is going to get mad at the teacher. And they get, so, yeah, they gravitate quite sensibly, given the system. They gravitate towards mundanity, boring, trivial, unimportant stuff that has no juice behind it. Because, any kind of values, any kind of critical thinking, any kind of skepticism is volatile. You don't know where the fundamentalist parent might be, right, of one kind or another.
And of course,
or who the kids are who have like three male relatives in Iraq, and you start talking about military industrial complex or the war. I mean, you're toast, right?
And remember too that most of these people who go into this profession are products of the system as well. So the first thing that happened to me when I got a job as a history teacher in a private school, 2004, was I was handed a copy of the Vermont State Standards. And, you know, through this process, through these 12 years, we learned that authority is the truth. So if this is the state standards, you know, from the Department of Education, who would question that? You know, and I had had this, you know, this wonderfully inspiring professor in college, and, you know, he turned out to be a socialist, as they do. But he really got me thinking, and he really sparked up my interest in the subject. And I had gone and I had created my own curriculum for American history. And I wasn't like, you know, making a big deal about rejecting the state standards, but it just was inconvenient for me at the time because I had this other stuff that I wanted to do. But I think that most people, you know, they're given a script and they're willing to follow that script. So I don't think most teachers don't have any malevolent intention. And I think most people get into this profession, even though this profession certainly has a tendency to beat it out of them, because they want to make a positive difference. They want to help young people learn. And I think that as their career goes on, the more they realize about the system, about the school that they work in, about the curriculum that they're teaching, the more that just kind of becomes a story that they keep telling themselves. But I don't think that they're conscious of any incentives against fostering creativity or curiosity. You know what I mean?
But you could say, Brett, isn't it possible that, I mean, in some senses, like, you might be quite unusual in that most people who want to become teachers probably have, you know, are actually more bought into the whole idea of, you know, the merits of compulsory schooling and the system itself. I mean, I know, like, my family's got loads of teachers in my family. My mum was a teacher as well. And I know that teachers do complain about the system and about, you know, its effects. But I wonder if also actually, in some senses, it attracts people who believe in it, in the same way that, you know, people who get involved in active politics ultimately complain about the government, but do still sort of, you know, get involved in participating in the machine, so to speak.
And they want to participate in the machine as, like, you know, dominating other people? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. I mean, like, to give an analogy, right, you know, there are many, many, socialists in particular, but other people who complain about this government, this state, and they may even have the ideas of overthrowing it with a revolution and this, that, and the other. But they're actively involved in political life, right? And in being so, in encouraging voting and in doing, you know, they, in a sense, they are actually just simply part of the, they're actually sort of supporting the system by participating in it. And I mean, I'm just saying, like, maybe teachers may complain about the teaching system, but I bet they're probably more statist and sort of more coercion oriented, you know, than maybe some other types of people, you know, more in the free market, because they are actually choosing to go into something that is quite a coercive situation, if you see what I mean.
And of course, as students, they probably experience it themselves. But what isn't it? You probably know this stat better than I do. Don't 50% of teachers leave the profession within the first 5 years? I mean, what is driving them out, you know?
This is conjecture, but I would think that that's the time when they have the most positive energy and you know, the right attitude, or they're most optimistic about this career. And I think very, very quickly. I mean, it took me, I began teaching in a classroom in 2002. I was out in 2006. I had seen all I needed to see.
So you're saying it's before their soul physically leaves their body that's still a chance?
Yeah, I mean, basically, I think that obviously the bribe in the education system, in the government education system, is tenure. And obviously all of the wonderful benefits, the pay increase guarantees that those can keep those things can keep people stuck in that system and rationalizing what they're doing as it's unveiled to them, what they're really involved in, or the damage in many cases that's being done. Well, what else could I do? Where else could I work 1,100 hours a year and make $60,000 and get a pension? And I think that when I've talked to teachers about these things, and maybe, you know, a lot of it had to do with my approach at the time, but the resistance, the outrage, the indignation that I was met with when I started to really, really challenge the roots of the system, it was amazing. It was overpowering. I was almost punched once by the husband of a teacher who just lived locally, who took such offense to the things I was saying. But I have to kind of think that they already know what's happening. And, you know, maybe that's some of the resistance, or that's some of the outrage that, oh, other people know too. Other people can see this too. It's a real disruption to the narrative.
Coming along.